Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Dr. Kyle Fishen, who serves as the Policy Director for the Health Alliance for Violence Intervention, HAVI. He leads the organization in coordinating, developing, and advocating for evidence-informed policy to end community violence. Besides this role, he continues to practice as an emergency physician and fellowship director in health policy with the University of Maryland School of Medicine. And with that, Dr. Fisher, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
No, the pleasure is all ours. Let's begin with your background. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and how you grew up? What led you to become an emergency medicine physician focusing on gun violence?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I'm in Maryland now, but I grew up in the Midwest. So I came up in Green Bay, Wisconsin, so pretty small Midwestern town, fairly unremarkable upbringing, like ran track and cross country in high school, you know, have a very big family, you know, that there's a big hunting culture in Wisconsin, so, you know, I got my hunter safety license at 12 and was in the woods, you know, going hunting. So firearms were, you know, something that were part of normal living in Wisconsin. Later went to school at UW-Madison and ended up in doing my emergency medicine residency training in Philadelphia before coming to University of Maryland after that. Along the way, I did find violence intervention to be a huge passion of mine. It came out of probably a combination of what I learned about the importance of advocacy and speaking up for your patients when I was at UW-Madison in Wisconsin, and this idea that you should use medical training to make your community better, not just one person in front of you, but it should be good. You should be doing your work in service of your entire community. And that really hit home for me when I was in Philadelphia doing my residency and experiencing gun violence, you know, every shift, you know, day in, day out, and you would take care of patients. And it didn't seem like there was enough happening to take care of them and the patients as a community. In not just, you know, the single patient that you're seeing and running through ATLS and treat him and treat him, that seemed broken. And I was incredibly lucky when I was at Drexel to have met Dr. Ted Corbin, who to this day is my, you know, I consider to be a mentor of mine. And Dr. Corbin had started the Healing Hurt People program, which is a hospital-based violence intervention program out of Drexel University, which was this better system for taking care of patients in the communities they live with. And that's how I ended up
here. I want
to
touch a little bit on your background. It's interesting. Now, growing up in Green Bay, because I think that presents a very interesting juxtaposition between what you're experiencing now practicing emergency medicine. Gun culture means many different things in many different parts of this country. At what point did you realize the concept of gun ownership is so dramatically different in different parts of the country? And did that at all come into the calculus in deciding to be an advocate for gun violence?
So, you know, from my background and growing up in Wisconsin, you know, what I've always taught or been taught by the people around me, my family and friends, that, you know, firearms are a tool. It's, you know, and you can use that tool for as either a way to hunt a deer or to, you know, engage in warfare. That's what it is. It's a tool. And so because of that, you know, address it straight on with what it is. And it's absolutely the truth that America has a very different landscape of firearm ownership than the vast majority of the rest of the world. But, you know, it manifests in different ways. So while there may be community violence in, you know, cities like Baltimore where I practice. But on the other hand, in like northern Wisconsin,
that's interesting because it's a very rural underlying area, what you're saying and much of your advocacy helps to provide that context. So, can you tell us a little bit about the Health Alliance for Violence?
Taking that just reality that the guns are in the communities and fitting solutions to how you can make people healthy.
Is that the context of the use determines the overall risk to the user. And I think that's an important point for people to understand the work you guys are doing. Intervention, what attracted you to that organization and some of the on-ground...
Oh, I'd love to. So the Health Alliance for Violence Intervention is the national organization that represents hustle-based violence intervention programs, just like the program I mentioned before, Healing Hurt People in Philadelphia. We have about 50 programs around the country now with about that many programs that are just starting up. We do a variety of different ways to try to build up this, you know, new healthcare system that better takes care of patients. We stand up programs or support programs that do want to stand up. We're not a top-down organization that, you know, hospitals pay us and we go in. No, it's the other way around. People in hospitals or communities that want to start violence intervention programs, we support them either through kind of peer learning and continual education for the programs that have already started. But we also do a tremendous amount of training and technical assistance work for people that are just getting started and they have heard about the solutions, maybe they've read some papers and they would like to launch a program of their own. So our actual largest department is in training and technical assistance because it is very challenging work. It is very technical. It is not something that someone can just say, oh, I'm a doctor, so I'm good at one thing. I can surely do this. No.
No, certainly.
And I think we have to know our limits. And this is one area where we can be a leader and help start things out and be the champion. But it really takes a big team and some help and assistance to make sure you do it right. Because we are talking about life and death here.
Mention, it's always in the context of, hey, let's prevent future gun violence. Or, hey, well, we stopped a future attack, so we're successful. But you feel that that's a very low bar to judge success. Talk a little bit people don't appreciate the full extent of work that's required. You mentioned last week at the Association of Healthcare Journalists conference that when people talk about gun violence prevention.
Yeah, that is a wonderful question. Let me just preface this by saying that, you know, I like to, whenever I go,
maybe even provide an example about some of the on-ground concrete work you guys are doing
to
really effectively change beyond just the buzzwords.
Gun violence is not one single thing, right? Gun violence is a number of different diseases. It's kind of like how, as doctors, we always kind of cringe a little bit when some politician says we're going to cure cancer, and we all say, "But that's like 200 different diseases. I don't even know how many cancers there are." Similar with gun violence, right? So there's community violence, or, you know, previously known as street violence or gang violence, things like that. Suicide, that's the number one cause of death from gun violence in America. There is intimate partner violence, you know, child abuse or child neglect, non-intentional. We don't like to say accidental because everything's preventable. Mass casualty shootings, and we could go on for a little while like this, right? So with all of these different types of gun violence, there are different ways to approach them. And just like to keep that in mind because depending on the listener, you might be in one space or another where it might make sense for you to spend more of your time, you know, for example, looking at suicide prevention rather than community violence, depending on where you work. You always want to match your practice to or your patients, where they're at. And so on the side of community violence, we do recognize at the hobby that it is incredibly important that we can save lives. You know, I'm an emergency physician. It's what I love to do, right? That's why we go to the ERs. We're hoping to save some lives. But that is kind of the start of the story and the lowest common denominator for what healing really looks like. And to think through this, let's imagine a patient. We'll call him Mike. Let's say Mike lives in my city in Baltimore, and he's living in West Baltimore, where there's been, you know, disinvestment for decades. There was redlining a long time ago. The lead pipes that were installed, you know, decades ago still haven't been removed. The neighborhood has, you know, been suffering from the opioid epidemic, which is still raising, still going strong. Their mass incarceration has really affected the community. And because of all of that, when Mike's, you know, before Mike has shot, we gotten injured, there's been a lot of going on. And when we think of adverse childhood experiences and that Kaiser study that came out decades ago, we know that adverse childhood experiences causes trauma and changes with our development. You know, when your baseline cortisol levels are changed because of these traumatic experiences, that makes a difference. And in communities that suffer from endemic gun violence, we know that those traumatic experiences, or ACEs, they cluster. So before Mike has an injury, he's already been exposed to that. And so now imagine Mike gets injured, he gets taken to a hospital where he gets a chest tube, he gets intubated, he goes to the operating room, and then thankfully he improves and gets discharged. But what happens after he gets discharged? So he's likely going to be discharged back to the same neighborhood that the shooting occurred. And on top of that, now he's dealing with all of the mental injury and social challenges that result from a gunshot wound. So post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't just exist in soldiers that return from Iraq and Afghanistan. The human brain does not recognize the difference between injuries in Baltimore and injuries in the Middle East. It's simply not the case. So we know that that's highly likely. There's actually data going back at least 30 years showing that survivors of gunshot wounds, about a year later, 80% of patients have signs and symptoms of PTSD. So what do people do?
And
well, there aren't a lot
the website
of psychologists
Hobby provides tremendous number of resources and educational content. There's a white paper that talks about like hospital-based violence intervention. There's an entire section on the website itself dedicated to the concept of advocacy. As you start to piece together what it takes, awareness, or is it the practical means to implement ideas that people already know of?
Cannabis is very common, and all of these things, you know,
to provide
interfere with
good intervention,
and we
comprehensive intervention, not just in the acute setting, but in the long-term chronic setting.
So
what are the biggest hurdles
kind of
you're encountering?
Cycle of violence, where one injury creates more risk factors for another injury, which can create more risk factors for another injury. And that's why you can really intervene at any point to help, you know, decrease the risk factors, bolster the protective factors, and do everything that you can to make sure that patients fully recover both physically, psychologically, and socially. There's so much that we can do. I think it's both. I think it's both. Hospital-based violence intervention programs have really picked up quite a bit of steam over the last few years, despite the fact that the first programs were launched roughly 25 years ago. The first programs, there was one in Oakland called Youth Alive that is still running strong to this day. In Milwaukee, there is a pediatric program called Project Eugenia, which is still a fantastic program. And on the East Coast, Boston Medical Center and Baltimore Shock Trauma Center were some of the originators. There's a few others as well. And so the program started 25 years ago, but you know, we all know in medicine, there's that old line that it takes, you know, 10 years between creating something and it being implemented in practice. And I think public health measures that are kind of systems-based approaches that aren't just like prescribing a statin, it takes even longer. So there is a lot of awareness that still is to be had. I know that I'm still talking to people every week and they're like, oh, I didn't know that this was an approach. I didn't know that this was something we could do. And people are generally finding it very, they're just relieved that there's something else that we can do besides that similar political debate that happens in Washington, D.C. about the Second Amendment and what should be, you know, where should we stand on the Second Amendment? I've definitely noticed that people are relieved to think of other solutions beyond that, regardless of where they sit on Second Amendment issues. But then to the second point that you had, we are talking about systems-based approaches towards violence prevention, and it's not, it goes beyond, you know, the clinic or the hospital or the emergency department. These are team-based approaches that, you know, you have to hire a frontline violence prevention worker that is going to really be the engine of these programs. These are, you might, for listeners, they might think of them kind of like a community health worker, but for violence. And depending on your community, you may have heard of them by other names. So violence prevention professional, violence intervention specialists, violence interrupters, credible messengers, lots of different names have been used. But we're talking about hiring new people. And the healthcare system, traditionally, and when it talks
understanding
about hiring
how
new people,
the financial correlates,
C-suite and other organizations want to know what
combining
that return on investment is going to be. And calculating the amount of money saved through prevention has always been something that we have had to work hard to show the value of. And sometimes it gets complicated because is the value to the hospital or is it to the community or is it to CMS? And those are challenges that we're really
clinical intervention
addressing.
Can you talk a little bit about successes?
I would say that I'm very pleased to say that we've had historic investments in community violence intervention programming, just like hospital-based violence intervention programs, for the last 2 to 3 years, more funding than ever before. And now is a really wonderful time for people to start looking into these programs because there is funding available from cities and counties, states, and the federal government now.
No.
It's interesting. You mentioned that you were quite successful with Medicaid, those financial correlates
Absolutely.
With the clinical metrics.
So, you know, I'm a public health, public policy guy and an ER doc. So it's a very, very practical, like, what are steps A, B, and C that we need to do to make sure we are successful? You know, that's kind of the EM mindset. And, you know, at the hobby, when we think about things, it's okay, we believe that violence prevention is a public health and a health-based issue. And if that's the case, how is that going to work? Well, it needs to be paid for like every other medical issue in America, right? We don't say that cath labs are going to be grant-funded and we're going to reapply once a year to see whether or not we can take care of patients with heart attacks. No. We say if you're qualified and you're running the services, when you do the services, we will reimburse you for it. And when the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, our patients that previously were highly uninsured are now in that Medicaid expansion.
Sustainability, you alluded to, right away we fall into, and I feel that whenever we talk about gun violence, as you say, silos, we look at things in terms of the Second Amendment, we look at things in terms of acute care setting or long-term residual effects, whether that's in the mental health.
We got the frontline workers recognized by the National Uniform Claims Committee, a committee that I didn't know existed until we started that program, and they're the ones that hold the master list of what a healthcare provider is. So violence prevention professionals, we got that added. And then we were successful in getting the Biden administration to include as part of their gun violence plan that Medicaid can and should be used to reimburse for violence prevention services. And after that, now we're up to five different states that have started using.
I want to touch on a word you use that I think is
California,
very
Oregon,
you practice clinical medicine, you teach,
Illinois,
and you advocate. That gives you a unique perspective.
Couple others that,
through that combined approach,
maybe coming down the pike,
do you see various measures that can lead to sustainability that perhaps we're missing when we're looking at it through our siloed approach?
If you launch a program, you have to know that you can pay your frontline workers salaries so they can put food on the table, not just today, but next year, too. People have families. They need to be able to have that assurance that their job is going to be there and not just, subject to the whims of some random grant somewhere. And it's critically important. If violence goes up in a community, these programs need to be able to hire more people and expand to address that.
Or the physical disabilities.
If violence goes down,
but we
don't
never
want it all or nothing.
Tie it together.
You have a program and you don't. No, you adjust and need to be able to scale down or scale up to meet the need. And that's what that reimbursement allows programs to do. Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I've really learned through this, three different things. Just to start, I want to say that for any of the listeners, I do think that having multiple different lenses that you're viewing your area of practice through makes you a better doctor, right? So learning the policy, learning the medicine, learning the programs, learning the advocacy.
Uh-huh.
I think it just makes things better for all of those different domains. By getting good at teaching, that's what patients need, right? Like patients want to learn about what's going on and understand their symptoms, and they want to understand what's next and what's available to them. And separately through advocacy, I have learned more about victim services and the relationship between the law and things that might be happening at the Department of Justice and my patients. So it really gives a broader perspective that you can take both the patients and your hospital and policymakers. And to that bigger question about how does this relate to advocacy, in medicine, I think we're all trained that if you're going to do academic medicine in particular, that there's one way to do it. You have a research problem, you apply for a grant through NIH or CDC or some other health-based organization, and then you do the research study, you publish a paper, and then you apply for more funding. And when you get into the advocacy community and the policymaking community, you really learn that there are so much more lenses to it. And in fact, for violence prevention, if you're just looking at funding and you're only looking at what the NIH or CDC has, you're missing most of the opportunity, because most of the opportunity to get these funds to deliver these programs is through either state victim of crime assistance funds, or there's a $100 million Department of Justice grant for this type of programming. So if you're only looking at one sphere, you're missing so much more of what's going on. And, you know,
and I'm
know
curious to
everyone's really busy,
perhaps play devil's
really
advocate and get your response. Many
more
people,
than just the medicine in front of
I don't
you.
Believe I that. And obviously your work attests to that not being true. But there is
guilty of overworking
at least
myself.
Inevitability to substantial parts of America, this notion that there's an in the gun violence. What do you see day to day in your advocacy clinical care that lets you know that, hey, intervention makes a difference?
Make sure that we have that broader understanding.
I think that broader understanding is critical to finding solutions.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, what I would start out by saying is that in the world, there are no absolutes. And even if we look at medicine and some of the best interventions that exist in the world, right? So think of aspirin for heart attacks. Aspirin for heart attacks. We know it saves lives, right? There's no discussion about it. That question was settled years ago. But at the same time, we have this thing that we call the number needed to treat. How many patients do you need to give the medicine to tip it over so that it saves the life, right? And that number needed to treat isn't one. In fact, in aspirin, off the top of my head, I believe it's 42, which is, it sounds like a lot, but a lot of people have heart attacks. And that's why we don't just do one thing. We do aspirin. We have cath labs. We control the blood pressure. We have so many different things that we do to increase the chances of saving lives. And violence is exactly the same, right? If we're talking about someone that is at risk of being a victim of gun violence, and that keyword is at risk, no one is destined to get shot. People may be at higher risk than others. But we
thoughts when it comes to
and
gun violence. You wrote an article in Health Affairs a few years ago now about, quote unquote, staying in your lane. From what I gather, great to effectuate change. But in this instance, I sense there's a certain level of passion
because there aren't jobs
directed in the article you wrote. What did you try to convey in that, and what was it about the events happening at the time, particularly with the NRA, that prompted that article?
These other factors, and then we address those risks. Because we know that if we don't,
sometimes we'll develop a fatalistic attitude to gun violence, saying that it's going to happen, and no matter what you do, it's inevitably going to happen.
There have been lots and lots of studies on this. In fact, I saw a systematic review. It was done a few years ago, where they identified 19 different trials that looked at what is the risk of someone
politically neutral
again,
because I sense
they've already been shot.
That's the best.
And that systematic review, the numbers come between, in the median, is 30% to 40%. Think of that. About 1 in 3 patients that get shot will be shot again. And these are otherwise healthy 20, 30-year-old guys that don't have diabetes or heart disease or a history of stroke, otherwise healthy. talking about 30%. There is a tremendous amount that we can do. And, you know, in America last year, there were a little over 20,000 Americans that died of homicides. And so if we cut that percentage down, right, we know nothing in medicine is 100%. But if we cut it down 10%, oh boy, we've gone from 20,000 and we've saved 2,000 lives. That's a big deal. And that's 10% is not even a big percent. I know we can do better than that. Yeah, so if folks remember, a few years ago, there was a set of guidelines that came out from the internists, I believe.
I like
talking
that.
About, and you know, gun safety.
And I want to transition a little bit to talk about the changing NRA hearts and minds. Obviously, when the NRA makes a misstep to that degree, there's going to be pushback in this biased, but day to day, we see really so much media cover narrative framework, often unintentionally
really from
biased framework, violence as almost caricatures
ER docs like me and
of
surgeons,
stereotypes that exist.
Internists and psychologists,
in your opinion, and, from the perspectives you have as clinician, advocate, and now policy leader,
don't tell me what I can't.
What's wrong with how the media
how
covers gun
patients.
Violence?
I know how to take care of my patients. I've got an eye on the community, and we know, you know, we can do this. And I was really proud to be a part of that movement and standing up because, you know, we, in medicine, we're trained to evaluate the literature. We're trained to look at a paper and say, hey, what works, what doesn't work, you know, what needs more data. And I think even though there are hot button issues and people arguing in Washington,
biased nonetheless, that simplifies those involved
very
in gun
solutions that, you know, don't have to be heated. Don't get me wrong. Don't tell me I can't take care of my patients. I'm going to take objection to that. And I did. But part of what this is our lane movement was about saying, hey, we've been studying these issues. We take care of these patients. We hear their stories. We are the ones that tell patients' mothers that they have died. And they are all telling us that something has to change, something has to improve. And we've looked at the literature, and here are some solutions. This is what the literature says. And we are members of this community and have knowledge and have expertise, and we are here to try to make our community better. Great question. It's overly simplistic, I think, is the biggest issue. It does oftentimes feed into many stereotypes that are often, frankly, racist in origin, right? When someone gets shot in a white community, they are talked about of they mentioned how they ran track in high school and talked about the promise of their future. But, you know, when my patients pass away, and coming from Baltimore, oftentimes all that
succinct but well said.
You know, and a young black man,
I would imagine Javi is at the forefront in those who are interested in getting involved in providing those solutions, and for them to collaborate with Javi at their own medical institution.
So I see
view and how can they get involved with Javi?
It can really improve. So one is, you know, infusing back that humanity in who these people were. Every patient and person that either dies or survives a gunshot wound, they have a story, they have a history, they have family, they have hopes and dreams and plans for the future. When that person dies, it is a tragedy for every person in their community. They're leaving behind kids and brothers and sisters. And, you know, I would just implore journalists to think through, okay, who's going to read this, and who in that community that knows that person, what would they think about this? Would they think this is, you know, an apt, you know, remembrance of the events of that day and that person's life? Because we are human beings after all. But then second, you know, I do think that there's a lot of work to be done to connect to solutions. We talk a lot about violence, and what I oftentimes see is,
or simply to get involved in general advocacy.
You know,
how can they get a hold of
this weekend in Chicago? The police chief says so and so. Well, what did the health commissioner say? What did the public health department say?
And with that, Dr. Fisher, I want to thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your advocacy at Javi and everything that you do, not just for your patients.
Have a good day. Talk to the police, you're only going to get one viewpoint.
For the community at large.
There are lots of solutions, like we've already said, between hospital science intervention programs.
Okay, perfect. You were great, and I will put the H itself, so as people are listening, they can select and link to
the multiple people that are part of this community that have solutions. You're not going to get the answer.
Good time, sir. Have a good day.
It's incredibly important that we really broaden
appreciate
the sphere
that.
Of the people who are asking about this, because
perfect. Thank you so much for.
If you don't ask for a solution, you're not going to get one. Great question. So I would say, first thing, just come and visit our website. It's www.thehavi.org. That's Javi as in the Health Alliance for Violence Intervention, H-A-V-I. Our website has a tremendous amount of resources. Like you mentioned before, that white paper that we have will teach you everything you need to know about the evidence behind it, the advocacy opportunities, and the history. So it's a great place for, you know, a budding doc to take a look and learn more. And then we have links to advocacy pages, too. In fact, we have different bullet points, whether or not, you know, if you're a doctor, if you're a healthcare system or administrator, or if you're a policymaker. And so we do our best to reach out to people so that they can, they know where to start. Because it's very confusing if you're not in the space, and most people want to know just where to get started. And people can always email me. I'm happy to talk and happy to connect people. So
I stopped the recording, so I think it went really well. I think various links onto the website or the podcast web.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. You too. Great. Thank you so much. This is good. Appreciate it. Oh, no problem. Sounds good. All right. Thank you. Take care.
Have a website as well. Another problem, and before I let you go, if you wouldn't mind sending me an email with a high resolution photo, I would.